Welcome to Ancient Greece Today. My name is Naomi Weiss. I'm a professor of classics at Harvard University, and I'm your host for this podcast series, which brings together scholars and artists to think about the ancient Greek world and its afterlives. This season has been Tragedy Today, and we have come to its end. It was going to be just 8 episodes, but here is a bonus one, an interview with Ferdia Lennon about his best-selling debut novel, Glorious Exploits. This novel is set in Syracuse, Sicily, in the late 5th century BCE. The Athenians' attempt to take Sicily, the great Sicilian expedition, has ended in their crushing defeat, and thousands of them have been imprisoned in the quarries, left to die there. 2 Sicilian men, one of them a Euripides superfan, decide to put on 2 productions with the emaciated prisoners, relying on them to remember Medea, long a famous play by this point, and the brand new Euripides, Trojan Woman. I wanted to talk to Ferdia about his use of tragedy in this novel, but also about comedy, which is there throughout too. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm delighted to be joined by Ferdia Lennon to discuss his 2024 novel, Glorious Exploits, a Sunday Times bestseller, the winner of the Waterstones Debut Fiction Prize of 2024, the Premio Gregor von Rezzori, the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, and the Bollinger Everyman Wodehouse Prize for Comic Fiction. That label, comic fiction, actually is something we could discuss in and of itself. It was adapted for BBC Radio 4, and translation rights have been sold in more than 20 languages. This is a book about tragedy and comedy in the wake of the Sicilian expedition. This was Athens's disastrous attempt to seize Sicily in 415 to 413 BCE, imperialism on a grand scale that went horribly wrong resulted in their utter defeat. So, Ferdia, thank you so much for joining me today for this discussion.
Thank you very much for having me, Naomi. Really delighted to be here and discussing Greek tragedy and the book with you.
The premise of this book, Glorious Exploits, is the story recounted by Plutarch that some Athenian prisoners in the quarries at Syracuse were saved as a result of reciting or even rehearsing, teaching lines of Euripides, depending on how you translate this passage. Could you talk about how the story of Glorious Exploits developed from that premise?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, I've always loved Thucydides. I've always loved ancient Greek mythology and history. And so the history of the Peloponnesian War is this 27-year record of the 27-year war between Athens and Sparta that spills all across the Greek world. And Thucydides sets to kind of give a detailed history of it. And in a sense, it is that war. But I've always found, in another sense, when you read it, it feels almost like a Greek tragedy about the fall of Athens. Athens becomes a kind of tragic character, where its hubris, the qualities that make it great, are the qualities that destroy it. And nowhere is this more evident than in this decision to completely unnecessarily invade the island of Sicily and try to conquer it and declare war against Syracuse, which is a city-state almost of equivalent size to Athens. And that's, in a way, and then if you think of the story as a tragedy, the heart of that tragedy really comes into the fray in this episode. And it always fascinated me. I always felt it would make a great subject for fiction, for a novel. But I didn't know what the angle would be. How do you approach this material? And then one day I picked up the Plutarch passage that you quoted, where he describes Athenian prisoners of war surviving by giving recitations or teaching lines, as you say, to theater-obsessed Sicilians. And we don't know, is this an apocryphal story? Did it happen? Didn't we don't know, but it completely captured my imagination. And my initial thing was, has anyone written this before? Surely this is, has this been a subject of a film or of a novel? And oddly enough, I didn't find that anyone really had. And you just start to think, okay, who were these characters that would be so obsessed with the work of Euripides or Athenian drama that they would go into this essentially what was a concentration camp or a death camp? These thousands and thousands of Athenian prisoners were left in these limestone quarries outside the city of Syracuse, and almost none of them survived. And it started to open up a few things that I think are interesting about Greek drama. So when we think of Greek drama, it's maybe something very highbrow. It's, you know, you go to the theater, it's, you feel very sad, you know, proud of yourself for getting your cultural, highbrow cultural fix. And I think in this, in the ancient Greek context, this was part of, it was a fundamental part of everyday life. And it went across all class divides. And I thought also so these characters that would be descending into these quarries to find snatches of Euripides, they were probably going to be the people that didn't have money, that didn't have any other way to access it. Mm-hmm. Because if they were rich, they could probably just get an Athenian slave or find some other workaround. And yeah, that opens up the decision of Athenian prisoners of war in this quarry left to die, and theater-obsessed Syracusans going in to try to get snatches from the plays. Once you almost take that decision, I'm not going to say the novel wrote itself, because it was a long and winding road, but it did. I think the situation has a kind of dramatic propulsion to it. Like if you want to organize a theater production, there are lots of things. You need costumes, you need to cast the actors, you need money, you need to feed the prisoners. Your cast of actors is made up of Athenian prisoners who had recently tried to invade and conquer the land of the audience. So that might not necessarily be the most popular decision amongst the entire Syracusan community. So it was an interesting, and I traveled to Sicily and I traveled to around Greece to see the quarries, see the places where the book was set.
That's fantastic. There are so many things I want to ask you in relation to what you've just said, but maybe to begin with what you just said, that you traveled to Sicily. I happened to go to Sicily about a year ago, just after reading Glorious Exploits for the first time. And as a result of reading your novel, I was really struck by the fact that the quarries are right next to the theater there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we went to see an amazing production of Sophocles' Oedipus at Colonus there. But before seeing the production, we were in the quarries, which are now they're called paradise, like the gardens around them. And I kept, as a result of your work, thinking of that juxtaposition of theatre that would have been performed at that site before the stone theatre that we now can go to was built. Where the experience of that, where you'd smell the rotting bodies that was like right next door. And I was thinking about that and Thucydides, as you were saying, and how he sort of really conceptualizes all of this in theatrical terms, and then Euripides' Trojan Women, and how there's this just awful mix of beauty and art and horror that really comes home if you, at least it did for me, if you visit the site itself.
I completely agree, and I think it's one of those qualities of research that I think, you know, you could be like, oh, I could go on Google Maps or I could read it up, but they're definitely changed. I think it helped me in the writing process massively, walking around those quarries, the smell, getting a change of the sense of the light, the eeriness of the whole thing, because you also have this odd disconnect of people there with their ice creams and their tourism. But if you're aware of the history, you just get a sense of do the awful events that have taken place here leave any trace, or is it just in the mind if you're aware of it? And as you say, you look up on the hill and you see the ancient Greek theater, amphitheater, quarried from stone, probably, I would imagine, from that, you know, quarried from stone in from a prison, from a site that was also a prison camp where thousands of Athenians died. And that theater, because most of the drama that would have been produced there would be the theater of Golden Age Athens. So there's a lot of contradictions and ironies that being in the physical space, I think, gives you that you could get from a text, but certain things don't. I think certain things need to be kind of seen and walked among.
And you in the novel toward the end, right? There's the decree that the Athenians just should be left to die, so that then the quarries can be used again to build up
the theater,
a great stone Syracuse, including the theater.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the idea. We need to open up the quarries again, and we need to get some. We need a stone theater that reflects the city that we've become. Because Syracuse goes from being, you know, becomes a great power in the region. It becomes a great Hellenic power as a result of that victory.
Right. Until the Carthaginians come along.
Yeah. And that's it. You get it's also that fascinating. You just get this sense of it's always shifting. You think, you know, if a city state or a power believes that it's on top, that some permanent kind of change of circumstances has been enacted. And then if you just read 50 pages on, or you look 10 years down the line, you realize it all changes.
That's a very strong theme throughout the novel. I guess that leads me to another question to pick up on what you said before, where, you know, you really got into thinking about all the technical parts of the production, the masks, the costumes, but also the music. So I'm somebody who, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the role of music in Greek tragedy in particular. And so I loved the fact that you brought in music and dance the rehearsals and the performances of the two plays. There's even an Aulos player, which I was delighted by. But the reason I bring this up in connection to what you were just saying is that there's also so much music in the rest of the novel. I mean, there's the Aulos that then Lampo learns to play himself, but there's Lyra, the enslaved woman at Dismas's tavern. And when she sings, it sort of, for me, it seems to just sort of expand the world, especially expands Lampo's world, so that he starts realizing that there is this larger cycle of suffering, of people being on top and then being at the very, very bottom. So I'd love to hear about, for you, the role of, I mean, that and the role of music in the novel.
Yeah. So I think, as you spoke to, I'm very interested in the sense of history of change and, you know, history is a cycle of impermanence, of shifts, perspectives, you know, the degree to which the meaning of a conflict becomes completely a heroic victory is a tragedy if you just from a slightly different perspective. You know, if you're the Athenians, this is the greatest catastrophe that they've ever experienced. It's the end of the Athenian Empire. It's the end of Athens as a dominant military political power. From the Syracusan perspective, it's going to be a song that will be sung throughout the ages. And that's always the story of war. It's where do you put the camera? Who tells the story? I think the music thing, one of the things, if you read the novel, you realize that I've chosen as a voice, the voice of the narrator Lampo, who's the Syracusan telling us this story, is that he almost sounds like a contemporary dub, like a Dubliner. And I think in a way, my way into this material, the kind of the alien sense of, you know, this is 2,500 years ago. So I read lots and lots of Greek tragedy and comedy and everything I could get my hands on. But there also is an imaginative leap. How am I going to try recreate this? And one of the kind of switches that I did was like, all right, I'm going to imbue the Syracusans with this kind of Irish lilt or this Irish voice and this Irish turn of phrase. And so in some ways, it's a very ancient, set in ancient Greece, but it's a very Irish novel. And one of the things, I think, human beings as well, music hits us right emotionally. It's almost like a direct link of feeling, of like transmission of feeling, or when you hear music. But like, music is very important to Irish storytelling, Irish ballads. I've recently been kind of reading about like the Irish War of Independence, and fundamental to the war effort were these Irish ballads that sprung up all around the country. Irish poets putting essentially like propaganda to music. And I think that is a reason why the ancient Greek theater was sung, and why it was danced, and why it was embodied in that way, because I think it just makes it land more effectively. And I think when I was researching the book, I was aware of this. It's one of those things I was aware, because I'd studied classics, that the chorus sang and it was danced. But you almost forget about it because it feels so different from the way that we imagine theater. You know it and then you don't know it. And so when I went back into trying to research the novel and imagine it and watching productions of ancient recreations of ancient Greek theater, I thought that was very important, that the music be kind of paramount, that you don't shy away from that, that these plays were almost like musicals. And yeah, and I think that's, and Lyra, yeah, when Lyra opens up and starts singing her stories, Lyra's his love interest. She's a slave who works in the local tavern. And one of the things that emerges when Lampo is interacting with this woman, who he very much tries to, he is both fascinated by her, is falling in love with her, but as he's quite insecure, and he's in the midst of that, the push and pull of trying to, like, let's not forget, you're a slave, and I'm a free Syracusan citizen. And I think, and yet what we realize very quickly is she's far more educated than him. And she comes from her position where she's from is, she's from a probably like a far higher social status than Lampo. And if it weren't for the vagaries and the vicissitudes of fortune, she probably wouldn't even be talking to him. And I think that's an interesting thing about the ancient Greek world, is that you have amongst you, you could go into a bar or in the market and have someone hauling crates who essentially was just at the wrong end of a war. And so the consequences of war are surrounding you in that way. And I wanted to bring that into the book.
Right. Yeah, that's great. And that kind of naturally leads to Euripides' Trojan Woman, which plays such an important role in the book. I mean, to be clear to our audience, there are two plays that the Athenians put on under direction of Gelon and Lampo in the quarries. There's Euripides' Medea, which I guess, like the Syracusans, the reader is most likely to have heard of, if they've heard of any Greek tragedy, if they've heard of Euripides. But then there's this new Euripides, you know, the new Euripides from Athens that is yet to be staged, the Trojan Woman. And that is theatre that brings home this sort of dramatic reduction from Hecuba being queen of Troy to being enslaved. And then usually you would have free Athenians, in Athens, but then free people elsewhere performing these roles. But you have enslaved or imprisoned people who can identify with the roles they play in sort of terrible ways, perform them. So I'd love to hear a bit about what brought you to Trojan Women. I know from our previous correspondence that this is a one of your, or you said it was a favorite play of yours. It's certainly a favorite play of mine.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible play. And I think it's almost, I don't know if I've read anything like it. I think even I have one of the characters, Lampo describes it in a way that it, you know, wouldn't be exactly the way I would describe it, but it captures something of the way I, usually in a play or a tragedy, we begin at a certain point. Things are, you know, Oedipus begins, Oedipus is king and he's respected. And what we see then is the fall of Oedipus. But, you know, and very often that is the structure of tragedy. Beginning from a state of like high status or stability, and things start to fall apart. Whereas one of the interesting things about Trojan Women is it begins with the women of Troy and Hecuba completely disempowered, enslaved, and things just get worse, and then they get worse, and then they get worse. And it kind of defies the rules of drama. But yet it's utterly compelling and strange. And you feel like if you read Aristotle's Poetics, when he describes the rules of what makes a play work, and he talks about Euripides, and he almost is criticizing Euripides, but he says, but he is the most tragic of the tragedians. And I think it's very true. There's a quality to Euripides' work and to that play in particular, or the Bacchae as well, that almost defies. Obviously, you can analyze it, but there's a strangeness to those works. I think that's part of their genius. They shouldn't quite work, but they do. So, but there's a very beyond the fact that I love the play, there's a very practical reason. It's actually the last play that is produced in Athens before the Sicilian expedition is launched. And so I was met with this very, you know, excellent soldier, you know, fortunate bit of synchronicity between a play that I loved that matched thematically so well with the themes of the novel, and actually was logically the most, it was the newest, freshest play. And this, you know, I don't really go into it, but it's I think it's implied in the book, and it's certainly in the way that I framed it, is that a lot of, you know, these characters, these Athenian prisoners of war, the way that these plays were put on at the Festival of Dionysia, some of them probably would have been involved in some way in the preparation, whether they were acting in the play, whether they were part of the chorus or the costumes. And so you have this really surreal situation where Athens is debating a massive, you know, aggressive war invasion of Sicily, whilst one of the great anti-war masterpieces is being performed in the city. And very likely the same, these prisoners who were, you know, acting in this play, putting on the, you know, the adopting the role of defeated Trojan women who've lost everything as a result of war, they're simultaneously trying to get their armor and their equipment ready to go and launch another war. It's one of the perfect examples of human beings' capacity to hold two contradictory things at once. So I loved, yeah, I just very interested in that aspect of performing this play as this war is being launched. And then also the fact that in a way, I think Euripides was probably, we don't know exactly, but previously Athens had invaded the neutral island of Melos and completely massacred the men and sold the women and children all into slavery before. And a lot of scholars have interpreted the kind of timing of how this play, the Trojan Women of Troy, was released, written so quickly after this event, that it was like a warning that Euripides was trying to make the Athenians at least consider the consequences of war, even when victorious. And yet, ironically, in a way, this warning was not so much, it wasn't fulfilled as a, you know, don't do this when you have the power to do this. In the end, actually, the Athenians are completely disempowered. And they become the women of Troy in this quarry. thousands of miles from home. But so it's it feels like something that would be written for effect, but actually it's just history.
Right. But the great thing about the way you approach this is to make us think about this play not just as looking back towards how the Athenians had treated the Melians as a result of their not wanting to join their alliance to pay tribute, and others. It wasn't just Melos that Athenians did this to, but that it also ends up looking forward, but as you say, in this different way, not as a warning about what you shouldn't do to others, but it turns the Athenians into the victims that they will become. And then I really like what you were saying about Trojan women in the last episode. Rosie, Ella, and I were talking about the weirdness of this play, the play where apparently kind of nothing happens. It's just a sort of series of things getting worse and worse and worse, and how, as a result, it's one of the most innovative. And one aspect of that was how it deals or doesn't deal with the gods. So there are two gods at the beginning of the play, but it's almost just so that they can be gotten rid of. So we're entirely on the human plane. And I really like how in Glorious Exploits, you do actually at one point mention a deus ex machina towards the end, but it sort of draws our attention to the fact that there isn't a deus ex machina here. We can only be on this human plane, which is both beautiful and then becomes utterly horrific. I really enjoyed that part of your novel too.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks so much. No, I mean, yeah, that's a really, I agree. It's one of the things that always strikes me about that novel is that in many, Trojan Women, is that it's really a novel that's, it's a play that in many ways you get a sense Euripides asking, are there gods at all? What is the meaning of this suffering? And do the gods exist? If they do exist, are they paying any attention? And I agree, that feels so much more real and vital in the way it's expressed throughout the play than those two guys got, the gods shuffling on at the beginning. You almost feel like that's how he gets it past the censors, or how that, that is something that Euripides felt like he needed to put in there. But the real, uncertainty is and tension is actually in the about that question is in the play. And it's a really, but also because it's so, it's the kind of thing that could easily just not work. And I forget the name of the king, but they might be apocryphal stories, but there's a story of this, I think, Greek king who is essentially like a psychopath, just unbelievably cruel and notorious for his cruelty. But when he watches, the women of Troy, this is like hundreds of years after Euripides is dead, he just can't, he just breaks down crying during even the most brutal despots, when he sees this play, becomes completely overcome. But it's a great play. And I'm guessing it didn't. I don't think it won. I don't think it won the prize.
No. Or at least the tetralogy it was part of didn't win first prize.
And that's the important thing, because I always remember Medea, I think, came third, but it's part of a series. So yeah, maybe the other ones weren't as good.
Who knows? But clearly it became very popular very, very quickly, as you show through this novel based on reality. I wanted to ask you about two aspects of the novel, which connects to Euripides as a character in the novel showing up at the end. And it connects to some of what you were saying earlier about these two sort of ordinary people and how they might be encountering, how they might be able to encounter plays of Euripides, and also about comedy as well as tragedy. So bear with me. The first thing is the setup, the fact that we have these two ordinary guys. They're kind of wondering what to do today. Let's go down to the quarry to see the Athenians. Then they come up with this grand fantastical plan about something that's it's all to do with like really serious real life stuff, but it involves a lot of comedy, a lot of swearing, a lot of Lampo's stupid jokes at other people's expenses. And as a result, the plan engages deeply with Euripides' tragedies. It all sounds very much like a comedy, or it could be a comedy by Aristophanes, almost. And then towards the end, we actually hear that the costume and mask maker, Alecto, is working on costumes for Aristophanes' Birds, which is a play about a couple of ordinary Athenians establishing cloud cuckoo land in the sky, a kind of utopia to escape to because of the terrible reality of Athens post-Sicilian expedition. So part of this very long question is about that sort of comic setup. But related to that, I've also been thinking a lot about the very end of the book, when Euripides comes in as a character. So suddenly it's 408 BCE. It's Euripides' last night in Athens before going to Macedonia. And the Athenian actor that Lampo saved, Paches, shows up to join and ends up joining the farewell party. And I may be off here, but this coda very much for me evoked Plato's Symposium, which itself is a dialogue in large part structured around theatre and it's comedy as well as tragedy. And at the end, Socrates says famously, well, we are told that Socrates said that the same person should write both a tragedy and a comedy, that the person who's expert at writing tragedy should also be expert at writing comedy. And there are other Socratic things that I noticed. But the point here is that I don't know how deliberate or not that was at the end, but I'm fascinated by your writing of a tragedy and a comedy in this novel. So the sort of the comic framing and the use of tragedy throughout. And I'd love to hear more about how you approached that combining of genres.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, I think it's all about who tells the story. And I think the material in many ways of this novel is so tragic. An Athenian concentration camp. If this novel was narrated by the Athenians, it would be an out-and-out tragedy, or it would be very, very, almost unbearably dark in some ways. I mean, maybe you could do it, but it would be very different tonally. If it was narrated by Gelon, who's Lampo's best friend, who is the real Athenian Euripides aesthete, who's obsessed with Athenian theatre, especially the work of Euripides. He's a much more melancholy, morose figure. But Lampo, in many ways, the comedy comes from the discordance between the way that Lampo sees things and describes things and interacts with things and the things themselves, and the way that the reader probably is aware of this discrepancy between what is probably appropriate and the way that Lampo is speaking about things. But I also felt his view is probably somewhat consistent. I have no doubt if you think of people in the Middle Ages going to watch executions or going to watch in the ancient Rome gladiatorial displays, I have no doubt, if I had to put my money, I would say that there were people, Syracusans, who went down to look at these defeated Athenians who'd arrived in their pomp and glory and mocked them and did not perceive their humanity, at least initially. So I felt it was both weird. The way that that comedic, jaunty tone was unsettling. But I also felt it probably had a psychological truth to it. And another way that I kind of, this is like a tragedy narrated by someone who thinks they're in a comedy until the tragedy becomes too much. And to a certain degree, until he starts to see the Athenians as human beings in maybe the same way that he sees himself or Gelon. And I think that's, I mean, that's the thing about drama, is that it's very hard to, the more you know about someone, the harder it is to just other them and dismiss them as something separate. And so when you're kind of walking through pointing at nameless Athenians in chains, it's that distance can allow maybe a level of cruelty that is just not possible after they've gone through the process of trying to put on this play together. And it's something I'm always in. I think it's, I mean, for example, Euripides, I think, does that so well, a tragic subject matter in a tragic tone. So that works unbelievably well. But I'm also interested in things like in an oblique, I remember Celine's journey to the end of the, you know, Celine's kind of, you know, journey to the end of the night, World War One. And I remember reading that, and it's incredibly bleak, but also funny. And there's a jaunty urgency to the way that that novel is, to the way the narrator describes things, that unsettles you, that feels weird. It's very informal. And that was helpful for me, because Celine actually fought in World War One and was completely traumatized by it. The thought that people don't always describe things the way that you think that they will describe them. And then secondly, as you spoke to Aristophanes, he was a big influence, because that was the other, they're rather than the mythic past. If you know, we're not talking about Oedipus the king, we're not talking about Heracles, we're not talking about Helen of Troy. In the work of Aristophanes, we're talking about Athenian political figures and the ordinary people of Athens, and they're set in what was then contemporary Athens. And they're bawdy, and they're sweary, and they're surreal, and they're irreverent. And so for me, I was like, oh, okay, we forget our conceptualization of Athens and ancient Greece very much is, I think, people in, you know, cloaks discussing philosophy. And I wanted to bring that kind of earthy humor, which I think is just as true to the world, kind of. You know, the cracks in the columns.
Yeah, Pakis himself makes this point, right? That Athenians aren't all about these sort of gloomy philosophical sayings, but that we're about laughter too.
As in the symposium, you completely get that sense of like singing and wine and good conversation and jokes and debate, you know? It's... yeah, absolutely.
And then also in Trojan Woman, we talked about this a bit in the last episode about comedy, because we were talking about Rosanna Bruno's collaboration with Anne Carson, turning this play into a comic book. And one of the things Rosie said is that Anne Carson described Trojan Woman to her as a comedy, at least in some respects. And Euripides as a comedian. And there is this one awful joke in it about how maybe Helen put on weight, and that's why, that's what Menelaus thinks. That's why he shouldn't bring her back to Sparta. But that whole scene, depending on the individual production, can be played, with a lot of comedy, and it is in the production within Glorious Exploits. But of course, that then encapsulates everything that you're saying too, that even within this relentless, awful tragedy, awful in the sense of being so devastating, there is comedy.
Completely. And I think that is in general, we have genres where we have tragedy and we have comedy. The truth is, life is always a mix. And comedy, and the line between comedy and tragedy, they can be juxtaposed. You know, moments can be absolutely devastating, and then there'll be a wry laughter or a joke. And I think that aspect of just being a human being, I think, is what interests me in the tragicomic mode. And it's probably easier to do a little bit in a novel, because a novel is in general longer than a play. so it can have within it that room. I'm thinking of what a big influence for me was Don Quixote, which I love, which, you know, is two very different, an odd couple setting out to do something that seems impossible. And that is very, very, I think it's very, very funny. But as it goes on, it gets sad and sad and sadder and sadder, and it becomes quite tragic. I think that kind of comedy, my favorite type of comedy in a way is comedy that's grounded in a kind of psychological reality in some way. And I think that it can that lends itself to moving between the two.
That's a great note to end on, I think, as I draw this to a close. Thank you so much, Ferdia, for joining me, for discussing at such great length this fantastic book of yours.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me, Naomi. It's been just really lovely to have this conversation.
My conversation with Ferdia about tragedy and comedy and how they come together in a work of modern fiction feels like a fitting conclusion to this first season of Ancient Greece Today, where we have explored both Greek tragedies themselves and their reworkings across different media. This whole thing has been something of an experiment on my part. I hope to continue it next year with a new season on Homer Today. Look out for it on podcast.chs.harvard.edu and on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Thank you for listening.